morning. I'm Colleen Wise. I'm the moderator of today's session, and I have the esteemed privilege of introducing our panelists and being the moderator for the questions coming in. Just an FYI, the session is we utilize a CWA app that you post questions on, and then I can receive those questions and cultivate them and ask them. There's also a note card system where if you raise your hand, the producers will give you a note card. You can ask your question, enter your question on the note card. They'll bring them up, and I'll correlate those questions. We will have time for about seven to ten questions at the end. If you are a student question does take priority, and we ask you to put that note that in the question narrative. So, I am, again, privileged to announce our panelists. We have Dr. Charles Vanderhorst. He's Emeritus Professor of Medicine and Infectious Disease at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. In addition to his work there, he volunteers twice a week as a primary care physician, and he implements a hepatitis C treatment program. We have Dr. Alan Lichter, who is a radiation oncologist. He was the former dean of the University of Michigan Medical School and the former CEO of the American Society of Clinical Oncology. Obviously, he has a lot to talk about the link between obesity and cancer and the addiction crisis. We also have Dr. Mark Thomas. He's a PhD professor of neuroscience at University of Minnesota, and he's the scientific director of the Medical Discovery Team on addiction. So, Alan, you can take it away.
Well, thank you, and good morning, everyone. I'm going to make a few remarks about obesity, which is fast becoming and will become the leading preventable cause of cancer in the United States. The scope of the problem is substantial. 4 of 10 adults basically are obese. About 5% of adults are morbidly obese, meaning over 100 pounds beyond their ideal body weight. Those are people for whom obesity impacts their activities of daily living. Interestingly enough, Colorado is the skinniest state in the United States. It ranks.
Could we turn off the other mics while the panelist is speaking?
It's kind of an echo coming through. Is that better?
Yeah.
Yes. So, in case you didn't hear, Colorado is the skinniest state, 51st out of the 51 states, with only 20% of the population being obese. So it's not like everybody is skinny here, but skinnier. But this is what many people don't recognize. They understand the relation of being overweight to diabetes and heart disease and even in depression and anxiety. But the connection to cancer flies under the radar for many people. Estimates vary. There are at least 120,000 cases of cancer a year that are related to obesity, and the number is probably higher. It's partly causative in breast, colon, esophagus, pancreas, a host of cancers. There is science behind this. Obesity leads to an accumulation of senescent cells. Senescent cells are cells that age, and they reach a point of transition where they are no longer vitally involved in the body's function, but they're not dead. And in this transition state as senescent cells, they are secreting toxic proteins, lipids that induce inflammation. They bring other healthy cells into a dysfunctional state. This occurs naturally with aging, and this aging senescence inflammation process has been tagged as inflammaging, but it is ramped up substantially with obesity. And there is a biologic connection between this obesity-related inflammation and cellular unrest and the creation of cancers. Obesity is also one of the major social determinants of health. This is this is one of several reasons why the life expectancy in the United States is not what it should be, considering that we're spending $3.9 trillion on health care. But the health care system is beginning finally to pay much more attention to this. We can talk about this in the discussion section. So why is the obesity epidemic upon us? You can look at slides of obesity incidents dating from the 70s to the present, and it's like a wave just crashing across the United States. Well, one of the amazing things is in the 70s we ran a nutritional experiment on the entire population of the United States when it was declared that that fat was the dietary enemy and low-fat diets were in. And I don't know if you remember this, but I certainly remember going to the grocery store and seeing a box of Snackwell cookies that said fat-free. And some of my patients would come in and say, I ate a box of those. I must be really on the way to nutritional nirvana. But now, of course, we recognize that this was a colossal error. Getting rid of this is taking a lot of time. But, having people gorge on these calorie-dense foods, even though they were low fat, certainly was part of this. We lead a more sedentary lifestyle. You're all with your iPads and iPhones and this, that, and the other, and we're not moving around as much as we used to. There's an interesting connection, potentially, between antibiotic overuse and obesity. Of course, when cattle ranchers want to fatten their cattle, they feed them antibiotics. And if you look at a map of antibiotic prescriptions per 1,000 residents and look at a map of obesity prevalence, the two overlay almost exactly. Now, that's not a causal proof, but it is a very fascinating thing to contemplate, because those two issues, antibiotic overuse and obesity, have occurred simultaneously. There are genetics involved. 80% of children of obese parents will be obese. We can talk about that. Socioeconomic factors. Obesity tends, bless you, to concentrate in states where there is more poverty, and carbohydrate-dense foods are cheaper calorie for calorie. And the obesity rate is unevenly distributed in this country, much higher in the Deep South and the Rust Belt, and lower in the West and in Colorado. So what do we do about it? We can spend some time talking about it. Calorie restriction is largely a failure. It can work short term. But as the joke goes, the two most popular books in the country are diet books and cookbooks. We just bounce back and forth between this. There are lots of reasons why caloric restriction is probably not a long-term solution. We can talk about some other diets in the discussion. I happen to think time-restricted eating is a very useful exercise. I certainly try to practice it. I've also become involved with the concept of intermittent fasting, which I also think has some very interesting biology and results behind it. But the bottom line is that maintaining one's body weight close to its ideal is a lifestyle change. It's not something you can do in a weekend and then we're all better. So with that, I'll just conclude my remarks, and I look forward to the discussion.
It's great to be back here and see many of you again. Is my mic on? Yes, it is. First, the story. As you know, I like to tell a little story. So when I was attending in the hospital at University of North Carolina one day, and my resident intern presented a patient to me, and she was in for her first terrible asthma attack, and she was a smoker, and she was obese, and I walked into the room, and I did exactly what my wife, who's also a physician, tells me that I'm not supposed to do. I start yelling at her. I said, "You gotta stop smoking," and I said, "And you gotta lose weight," and then she's telling me, and I ask her about her life. So she's working two jobs. She's working for the University of North Carolina, earning way low, like you can't survive on the thing. And she has another job cleaning an office building. And so when is she eating? At 1 in the morning. Where can you get food at 1 in the morning? McDonald's, Burger King, Wendy's, places like that. And her husband was working two jobs just to make get by. So that's one of the problems of why we have an obesity, because it's cheap and it's there. So just a couple other figures, facts on obesity. So there's an estimated 300,000 deaths a year are due to obesity. It's the second only after tobacco of things that end up in death. Addiction is there are approximately 20 million people in America who are addicted. I'm not talking just intravenous drugs, but alcohol, not smoking. And 8.5 million of those are also have a mental illness. So they're self-medicating their mental illness by using drugs because they're not, they haven't been diagnosed with their depression or their schizophrenia, et cetera, or their anxiety. So instead of getting a pill, they're using alcohol or other substances. And 70,000 people overdose every year. And I've started, as I volunteer, I thought I knew addiction because when the university banned smoking in the hospital, you could still smoke on the grounds. And I remember walking out in one of our cold winter rainstorms that we get in North Carolina in January, and I see the janitor who earns $15,000 a year next to the neurosurgeon who earns $600,000 a year puffing on cigarettes in the rain. So, and then I said, oh, that's an addiction. And now that I'm volunteering in a clinic and I started treating hepatitis C, that's what's driving the hepatitis C epidemic now. You all know as baby boomers, you should be tested for hepatitis C because you may have had a transfusion way back when with contaminated blood before we knew about hepatitis C. But now it's people who are sharing needles. They're transmitting hepatitis C, B, and HIV. And it is such a struggle. I mean, these folks come in and they are haunted. It's so our image of addicts is sort of ne'er-do-wells, you know, and it just grips their life. It's like they have absolutely no control. So the converse, when they're able to stop, is an amazing thing, that they can stop this thing that has just grabbed their soul and is sucking the life out of them, that they've lost family and children and spouses and jobs, and they're in the streets. So they will leave a treatment center when it's 20 degrees, you know, below freezing, and they'll go into the streets because they can't handle the hunger, the craving they have. So it's a very tragic thing. And one of my patients, another story, he tells me, he said, so how have you been able to control things? He says, well, I buy Suboxone, which is one of the, you know, you've all heard of methadone, which is a way of you get daily methadone dose and then you stop injecting and they test your urine. Suboxone is another drug that has been used, less potent than methadone, that's worked very well. And you buy it in strips and you sort of take a little strip into your mouth and it releases the drug there. And this guy, he couldn't get into the system, to the regular formal system, so he buys the actual drug, not, you know, fake drug from Asia or Mexico or something, but he buys the actual stuff that's prescribed in the street so he can get it, which told me that there's a huge need for treatment in this country that we're not meeting. If my patients know they need treatment, are willing to stop injecting and doing robbery to get the money for it, and to go to the trouble to buy Suboxone in the street. Then the third thing we have is stress. And 10 million Americans have a major depressive episode in the past year that resulted in significant impairment. So I'm not talking the mild depression or even situational depression after you lose a loved one or something like that. But I'm talking so bad that you can't work, you can't take care of your children, etc. Suicide, which is obviously a result of depression, there are 1.4 million attempts in the United States every year, and about 50,000 result in death. And half of those are due to firearms. So why do we have that? We've talked about some of it with the corn syrup that was added to all the foods that we have that has all this excess calories, and you could say low fat on the boxes. Food is love. It gives us comfort. We get deal with stress and depression by eating. That's what our mother gave us. You know, it's like having breast milk again. So we're addicted. Food is a convivial thing. We gather around the table. It's, you know, love, friendship, etc. Some of it is a little more insidious than that. We get addicted to the food by the fructose syrup, and that's why the various soda companies fight the tax on high corn syrup drinks so hard and win usually. And then there's the narcotic thing we now know, and Alan probably remembers. I mean, when in the old days we were worried about under-treating pain in cancer patients. And then what happened is that, I actually don't know the sequence, and I actually want to go back, and I've told a couple of reporters that I know at Kaiser Health News that they need to go track this down. When did we come up with the pain scale? That everyone's supposed to be asked about the pain scale. What the hell are you asking somebody with the sniffles about the pain scale? And then it had to be all hospitals had to have it in their clinics, et cetera, et cetera. And the moral being that we're not giving enough narcotics. And a lot of that was fed by the pharmaceutical companies that are now being successfully sued about that. So that's, I think, you know, one of the causes of that. The other thing about stress is that, you know, when I grew up, my mother was home taking care of us. Now, to get by, everybody has two jobs or more. You know, every family, both partners are working. So who's taking care of the kids? You know, those of you who read the newspapers and are aware that racism and the anti-immigrant thing takes an enormous toll on these kids. Can you imagine, as an African-American parent, having a boy who's about to become a teenager, what the fuck are you going to tell this kid? You know, it's like crazy. I just, when I think about it, because I have African-American friends, I said, I would be terrified. I'd move out of, you know, I'd move him to Paris like James Baldwin did, you know, to be safe. So the DACA kids, imagine the stress they're going through. Our children are very worried about the environment. I remember when I was in high school which was in the 60s, the late 60s, we'd had three assassinations. I was about to get drafted. We thought there was going to be a nuclear holocaust, as you recall. The cities erupted with violence, the troops entered our cities. And I thought, I'm not going to have children. I'm not going to bring them into the world. This is just a terrible thing. And we got through that. But this generation doesn't know. So they see Al-Qaeda, they see these endless wars, they see the environmental catastrophe, the fires in Florida, the anti-immigrant where they're rounding up people in rural North Carolina, raiding factories and things like that and hauling people away, crying babies. I mean, it's like a mess. And now a nuclear thing has come back. That we thought was gone, but now we're backing out of treaties, etc. So I think that is creates a lot of stress on folks, what to do. So there's and then strangely, there's this issue, I think, for physicians that we talk about. Many of you know there's an elevated rate of suicide among physicians, and I wrote a column about that that went viral a year ago. And I think one of the issues, a cousin of mine was going into plastic surgery, and he was all idealistic. He was going to take care of burn patients and women who had mastectomies and things like that, and now he's doing boob jobs. And the issue is, and Botox injections, and he's miserable. And he told his child who wanted to go into medicine not to go in. But what's going on? He's living in a really expensive house. Even though he's got great public schools in Westchester County, he's sending his kids to private school. They go on expensive. So he's got golden handcuffs. And he has a summer house. So he has to bring in that money so he can pay for his lifestyle. And when my depression got out of control, that was we had bought a second home, and my entire after-tax paycheck as a professor of medicine was going to the mortgage. So, and I felt trapped in my job. And when I got depressed and suicidally depressed and finally realized I need to leave UNC, the first thing we did is we restructured the debt and sold the home, and all of a sudden, half my stress went away. So there, I think for people who don't have to struggle with racism and poverty and paying the bills, etc., I think you get this golden handcuffs. Everyone wants to acquire something. And then housing, obviously, is a big cost. So what's the solution? And I'll just whip them off and stop here. Universal health care, take a lot of stress off people. Preschool education, universal. Child care, how can you be a poor person and work and not with your kids? Who's going to take care of the kids? College tuition for service. You work a year, you get a year of college tuition, or 2 to 1. Minimum wage has to go up to $15. We need to tax sodas. There's very good evidence on cigarettes. If you raise the cost of a dollar, a friend of mine, Phil Cook at Duke, did really good research. It's a straight line. You raise the tax on cigarettes, it goes down, smoking. And that's an addiction, and you're making it go down. You have to do the same thing on sodas. You need to redesign neighborhoods to get rid of cars, make people walk. They should walk to the grocery store. The schools need to have exercise programs. If you start with exercise in the morning, there's very good evidence that kids are awake better, they learn better, they're healthier, etc., and better nutrition. And then, when I was seeing patients every 15 minutes, very little I could get done besides rewrite their prescriptions. And the free clinic, I spend an hour with each patient. They lose weight. They stop smoking. They stop drinking. 4 of my patients on the hepatitis C program had been drinking for 30 years, and they stopped drinking because I can have a relationship with them and talk to them and figure out what will help. It's called motivational interviewing, but it works. And so I've learned that. So I'll stop there.
So I'm the odd one on the panel. I'm a researcher. I'm a neuroscientist, a biologist of the brain, and I don't see patients. But I think about them a lot and what we might do to help them with our research. I'm just going to give you a little history about my interest in this, and hopefully that'll lead to some interesting points for discussion. So I became fascinated in the idea that as an undergraduate that the brain changes with experience, and to me, when I came across this idea that you could make a living trying to learn about how the brain changes with experience, that was a pretty amazing idea to my 18-year-old self, although it's still amazing to me now. So I ended up studying the molecular and cellular basis for these kinds of experience-dependent changes in the brain, for example, in learning. I did that as a graduate student, got my PhD at UCLA. And as I was doing that, I became very interested in the idea that exposure to certain stimuli, for example, addictive drugs, could also produce experience-dependent changes in the brain, but those weren't necessarily adaptive changes in the brain. They're maladaptive changes. And so, you know, this goes for addictive drugs, but also could go for, you know, exposure, chronic exposure to calorie-dense and nutritious, food that lacks nutrition, or stressful experiences. That could lead to things like PTSD. So these experiences can clearly change the brain, but it's not always in adaptive ways. And so I spent the rest of my career, starting then as a postdoc at Stanford and the University of Michigan, studying models of this kind of thing in rats and mice. And we can talk maybe about how we would compare what we see in those species to what we could learn that would be useful for people. So the thing that I really want to get across to you, and I want to mention it now so that I don't forget to come up on it later, is that these maladaptive changes that happen in the brain are, we think, significant barriers to lifestyle changes that might otherwise allow us to deal with things that like addiction or obesity or our sensitivity to stress. And so the more we think in the neuroscience realm, the more we learn about these brain changes, the more that we can try to target those specifically. Or we can at least use them as biomarkers to see whether lifestyle changes that people are affecting are actually producing beneficial effects on the brain that could last. And that's another key point, that these stimuli in our environment produce changes not only at the moment when they're happening, but they're lasting changes. And there's individual to individual variability. We see that in the rats and mice, just like you would see it in people. But the more that we learn about it, the more we'd be able to track it and to target it with new therapies. And that's where the whole group of us around the world who are doing these kind of studies are headed. And I think if we're successful, it's really going to transform medicine for mental disorders, because this goes across just not only in addiction and PTSD, but has implications for anxiety disorders, depression, autism, and schizophrenia and others. So I'm going to stop there and hopefully have some good questions and good discussion.
Great questions on the app, but if you want to write your question down on a note card, just raise your hand and our program directors will come around and give them to you. So we have a couple questions from the audience about the specific diet, the caloric restriction, this fasting concept, and how we can implement that in our lives. So if we could talk a little bit about how we can utilize your concepts to improve our own health.
So, as I say, listen, there's nothing wrong with caloric restriction. If you have the mental changes in your brain that says, I'm just going to eat less, do it. It can work. It's just that we don't have these. We do it for a while. And as you know, from a physiologic sense, our bodies were designed to, back in prehistoric times, to eat periodically. When we found the woolly mammoth, we ate, and in the next week, when we were hunting the next one, we didn't eat. So the body is adapted when calories are restricted to slow metabolism down. This is one of the one of the dirty little tricks that nature has played on us. This is in part why if someone says, I used to weigh 180 pounds eating this, then I went on a caloric restriction diet and I lost 10 pounds at 170. If I just eat that diet again, I'll now stay at 170. No, you won't. You will go right back up to 180. Not only because your body has more it is more attuned to using less calories, and so when it gets back to your quote normal diet, it's an excess. And also a concept that is an interesting one.
Too dark.
Whether in fact most of us in fact have a set point where our body is in. In balance. And so caloric restriction is, I'm not trying to say don't do it, it's just it's hard to have the discipline to do it, and it's a permanent change. It's not like if I can lose 10 pounds I can just go back to doing what I was doing before. You've got, this is the rest of your life thing. So great, if that works, do it. Another way though is something called time restricted eating, where and I think the classic form of doing this is eating for 8 hours and fasting for the other 16. So now here's something heretical. Skip breakfast, which is what I do. I have my first meal at lunch. I have dinner at 8 o'clock. I'm done grazing. And I don't eat again until noon the next day. And this has, in clinical tests, is a relatively effective way compared to caloric restriction leading to weight loss. The reasons for it are speculative, but the body seems to respond to periods where it is not eating and having to use its own fat reserves to provide our energy. We have killed this idea because we constantly graze. The fridge is full of stuff. The cabinet is full of stuff, and we wander by and we just, you know, grab ourselves 6 cashews and a couple of chocolate covered almonds and maybe a little ice cream thingy dingy. And we just, you know, just look at your own lives. I confess that was me. And I think the nice thing about time-restricted eating is there's a nice discipline to it. You don't have to remember a 72-page formula and, you know, with square roots of this and the this, that, and the other. Just I eat, and you can pick what you can eat. You can eat breakfast and eat into the afternoon and stop. But I think the general concept is about 8 hours where food is coming in and 16 hours where no food is coming in. And I think it's worth a try. It's not dangerous, and it's effective. Fasting is also an interesting concept. The body responds to fasts in very positive ways. Take away the hunger part of it for a moment. Senescent cells, these zombie-like cells that are in part at the root cause of many health problems, these cells don't like to be in a fasted environment. They die, and they die preferentially. The body gets a signal and begins to produce more stem cells. So when you study patients during and after a prolonged fast, their stem cells are increased. The circulating hormones that are detrimental start to go down. The positive ones start to go up. Blood pressure goes down. People who are have metabolic syndrome or diabetes can get rid of that through a program of periodic fasting. The data is quite intriguing. The problem is fasting is hard to do. A water fast is a very unpleasant thing. So what has happened is that nutrition scientists have created things called fasting mimicking diets. That is a program diet that allows you to blunt the hunger allows you to retain lean body mass. A water fast allows you to lose fat, but it also loses lean body muscle mass as well. So it allows you to retain lean body mass better than a water fast, and produces much the same results. Now, I'll admit that I'm an advisor to a company that produces a product like this, but there are many companies that do it. And if you look online and just Google fasting mimicking diets, you will see an assortment of programs that one can take that give you the benefit of a fast without having to go through the torture of a water fast. The program that I do three times a year is 5 days long. Am I miserable? Yes, but only because I miss food. I mean, I like food, and not have, here's what you eat for breakfast and lunch and dinner, and it's, you know, it's okay, but where's the hamburger and where's my martini? And that's psychologically painful, but it's perfectly fine. And I think you'll see more and more of this going on. So there's lots of information out there, much of it quite good information on alternatives to simple caloric restriction that I think are, for most of us, will be more effective.
Thank you. That was very helpful. We have a couple student questions that focus around the link between anxiety and depression. One question is, please discuss the causal chain between depression and overeating. Which causes which? And how do we break the cycle? Also, what's the main cause of someone's addictions? And just an anecdote, the student writes, a friend of theirs has anxiety and depression, but refuses to see a professional about it. And they use marijuana almost every day to cope. They don't believe that they are addicted or have a problem. Should I be worried, and what should I do to help them? So,
I think the three panelists. I'll deal with the student friend issue. So there's a very simple maxim that physicians use. We talk about patients have their independence and you need to let them do. That's true unless they're a danger to others or themselves. So, and there's a very, the first thing you need to do is, first of all, you can go online, and there's the PHQ-3 and the PHQ-9, I think it is, which is patient health questionnaire screening for depression. So one's just three questions, the other's nine. And if they get a score that's, high, then that's a diagnosis of depression, and they need to be treated. So that's number one. Number two, the concern obviously is that with 1.5 million people attempting suicide, your friend is at risk of that. We certainly see that on college campuses a lot. And it's very simple. And actually, my niece tried to take her life and almost succeeded when she was a college student. So, and you ask them, have you had any thoughts of harming yourself? Question number one. If they say yes, he said, have you made a plan to do that? Yes. The next question is, do you have the means to do that? Okay. If they just say they have the suicidal ideation, that they've had thoughts, that's not an urgent thing. But if they've made a plan, and certainly if they have the means to, like a firearm at home, or they've collected pills, etc., then you can't leave them alone, and you have to escort them to the emergency room where they can be screened. And then it becomes an urgent thing. So you need to do an intervention with your friend. That's right. And you can get friends to help. You can contact. Again, you say someone has independence, not if they're going to be a danger to themselves. And then you need to think about contacting the school health folks, their parents, SIBs, whatever.
So there was a question about what was the specific question?
What's the main cause of someone's addiction and the causal chain between depression and overeating?
Okay, well, I can take the first one. Just talking about it from a neurobiological point of view. So there's a circuit in each of our brains that we call the reward circuit.
and evolved through evolution to direct our behavior towards stimuli in our environment that predicts the availability of what we call natural rewards, like availability of nutritious food, opportunities for sex, building social networks, things that promote the survival of the individual and the species. But drugs, all the drugs that people abuse act on that circuit in a pretty specific way to enhance the signaling of dopamine. The meaning of a dopamine signal in the brain is something that neuroscientists have been debating for decades, but we're homing in on the idea that when dopamine is present, or when it's released, that's basically a signal telling the individual, pay attention to this situation you're in, and take advantage of it, act on it, do this again if at all possible. So it's not as much about the pleasure that you might get out of that thing, but it's directing your behavior to do it again and again. And addictive drugs they jack up that signal in a massive way. And so the signal that the individual is getting is that you want to do this again and again, even if it doesn't necessarily produce a kind of pleasurable response. It often does initially, but not always. And so that's a short neurobiological explanation, anyway, of how, what is it that happens in someone who's addicted? Why do they become addicted? Of course, there can be two people who have identical drug histories but not necessarily have the same response to that. And, their brains weren't maybe the same to begin with and didn't change in the same way with the experience that they had. But we think that the changes in that reward circuit are what are important for addiction and what we need to try to target in new kinds of therapies that we don't yet have. That's my best answer.
So it's a great question. There is a strong association between obesity and depression and anxiety. The incidence of depression and anxiety in the obese population is substantially higher than it is in the normal weight population. I have to say I don't know, and I'm not sure if medical science knows whether the chicken or the egg came first, whether this the anxiety predates and feeds into the excessive calorie intake or vice versa, but there is a strong relationship, and obesity researchers are working to try to break this cycle. There's no question that those who are successful in bringing weight down towards normal body weight relieve much of the anxiety and depression that they have. So there is some type of relationship, but I can't tell you that we know for sure what's first and what's second, but there is a powerful association.
Excellent. So another question is, this is kind of on the same line. What are the maladaptive changes that occur in the brain? Are they physical, structural, or biochemical? And are these changes treated or remedied? You spoke to it a little bit.
I can try to address that. So, yes. No. Are they, how was it phrased? Are they biochemical, structural, or?
Physical. Physical, structural,
yes,
or biochemical.
They are all three of those things.
And how these changes can be treated or remedied?
Not yet. And that's I think, the crux of what we and many others like us around the world as researchers are trying to understand. We need to know the key changes that relate to the changes in cognition and behavior, the troublesome changes in cognition and behavior that happen in people who are having substance use disorders. What we've identified over the decades that people have been studying this are
a lot of different brain changes that are happening, it's very hard work to tie those specific structural, physical, or biochemical changes to cognition and behavior. It's, in a sense, that's all of what neuroscience is trying to do, to understand the brain. What are these chemicals doing that relate to the experience that I have as a person? I mean, that's a big, difficult question. And that's one reason why I like studying this stuff, because in a way, addiction is, I think of it as where the mind meets the brain in some ways. So to me, it's a fascinating question that has these important implications for society.
Mark, what, in my sort of experience, and I don't know if this is, fake news, for people who were addicted to crack, it wasn't, the true addiction, but the issue was the triggers. If they went back to their old neighborhood, that would all of a sudden do that, as opposed to heroin, where, you want the drug itself, no matter where you are.
That's very interesting you point that out. I mean, so the different drugs definitely act in some very similar ways on this reward circuit that I was mentioning, but there are some critical differences too, and it's sometimes hard to keep those in mind when you're in a sense looking for the similarities that relate to the drug craving that happens across drug classes that people have. But that's a really good point. For you mentioned nicotine, and nicotine is one where it really enhances the noticeability of those cues that surround the drug, and I think cocaine is like that too, and maybe a little bit different than heroin in terms of the cues that would provoke the drug craving.
Yeah, for smoking, when I deal with my smokers, I say, once you decide, you have to get rid of all the ashtrays in the house, clean out the car. No one can smoke. If your wife smokes or your cousin, they can't smoke in the house or in the car. And just get rid of that smell as best you can, and go cold turkey.
I think one of the challenges, though, is that almost anything can be a cue to a person,
right?
Because we have such mental activity. It can be, a song that you hear on the radio or something. It could be, can really come from out of nowhere, which is why that we really want to understand the neural basis of those things and not necessarily in the future have to depend on removing all the cues from the environment, for example. I mean, what we have now for dealing with obesity and stress and addiction mostly are lifestyle changes, because we just don't have much else. I mean, and we need more, and that's where I think the research comes in.
I'd like to just pick up on something that Charlie said in his opening remarks about the underlying roots of this massive narcotic addiction problem we have in the U.S. I mentioned the massive experiment that we did on the population of this country by saying if you eat low fat you'll be fine, and that turned out to be a catastrophe. And Charlie's point about the pain being brought forth mostly by the manufacturers of the narcotic drugs as being the fifth vital sign. So you had to measure blood pressure and respiration and heart rate and so forth, and then you had to measure pain. And the Joint Commission on Hospital Accreditation, the organization that allows you to be a healthcare organization, made it mandatory that at every patient visit, a Likert scale, you had little smiley faces, and your patient had to check these boxes. And we were scammed by the pharmaceutical industry. I was taught, and so I taught my trainees, that if you are treating legitimate pain with a narcotic, the chances of addiction are like in tenths of percents. It doesn't happen. And so we told all our trainees, don't worry about giving your patients narcotics if they have pain. If they come to you and say, I'm addicted and I want narcotics, let's get them to treatment. But if they, you know, if their knee hurts and it really hurts and the little smiley face has a huge frown, just do it. And it will solve the pain problem. And you were, as a medical organization, you were graded on how well you responded to this, how many of these prescriptions you could give out and make your patients pain-free. We were going to live in a pain-free society. We medicalized pain. Pain sometimes is your body's, your knee hurts because you're doing something that your body doesn't like. And one thing you need to do is stop doing that or start to do something to allow the body to heal that. But no, we were going to throw all this stuff. And you probably all have this. I remember my wife going to the dentist. She had a little dental work. She gets 30 OxyContin. And now why 30? Because it turns out the research now shows you don't need any, and the Tylenol or ibuprofen can do it. But heaven forbid the patient would run out and would have to call me, and I'm on the I'm on the golf course, or I'm doing this, that, and that, or it's late at night. So let's just make sure they never run out. Then 2 weeks later, she went back for the second part of the procedure, and they tried to give her another prescription for 30 OxyContin, and she was wise enough to say, I have a lifetime supply that you gave me the last time. And these drugs become redirected. These drugs end up in medicine cabinets, and they end up in the hands of people that they shouldn't end up, and they end up on the street. And we, Conference on World Affairs might want to have a panel on the things we've done, experimenting on the entire population of this country that have turned out to be catastrophes and disasters. And now we have, just to show you how we are capable of screwing it up again, we have pegged the meter in the other direction. There was a wonderful piece in the New England Journal of Medicine just a few weeks ago of a patient who, in fact, had chronic pain. And his life was managed on a chronic dose of narcotics with his long-standing physician, who retired, and he gets a new physician. Physician says, "I'm out of my drug, and his previous doctor just renewed it." The new physician, because of the scrutiny on this, the well-intentioned scrutiny, says, "You have to come to the office." And it was 3 or 4 days before he could get an appointment. During that time, he was in a lot of pain, but he went. And then he gets just a small prescription, right, a 7-day or whatever. And then the process starts again. And he is in chronic pain. And he ends up on the street to get his drug and ends up in the legal system, et cetera, et cetera. So we have, there are legitimate, we need, we constantly head the needle this way, create a huge problem, then wong, we swing the thing all the way to the other side to fix it. There is something in between. Cancer pain, when studied, and it's been studied a lot and continues to be studied, is still probably undertreated. But it is very difficult now in this environment to get the right drugs to the right patients when they need them, because we've given so many drugs to the wrong people. And you read about Purdue Pharma and Mallinckrodt and all these companies who fed this system. Can you imagine little pharmacies in small towns in West Virginia getting hundreds of thousands of doses of this drug, enough to feed that county for 100 years, and nobody is paying attention that something is going on? It's just, and you now are seeing the lawsuits and so on and so forth.
So we have some questions on, one is the three long-term investments that we should make to disrupt the addiction behavior epidemic in our cities. And that is affecting, causing the most vulnerable houseless population. There's also a question on how do we remedy the issue of the low socioeconomic impacts on health and addiction and obesity. And then more pragmatically, if you have someone that needs a treatment program, how do you lobby to enable those treatment programs to be open to all age groups? So it's a three sort of three part, you know, the three long-term investments that we should make, and maybe touch on your treatment programs for hepatitis C patients and how you do that at a more granular level.
Well, I think some of them are going on right now. So for addictions, the three long-term investments, one thing I would view if you had universal health care, then these folks would have health insurance. My state didn't expand Medicaid, so they don't have any eligibility. So if you're addicted, how are you going to get your treatment paid for? But the issue in terms of prevention is cutting off the supply that we've been overprescribing, and that's already happening. But it's a little slow to happen. I mean, my daughter, who's an orthopedic surgeon, says that, you know, a lot of orthopedic surgeons still are giving, you know, too much OxyContin out. And most people now recommend that you just get, you know, you can get major procedures with anti-inflammatories as opposed to narcotics. You want to take a crack?
I'd like to throw research in there as
yeah.
one of the. And it might sound self-serving, but I'm doing what I'm doing because I really am. I'm committed to it. I'm very optimistic about it, and I'm not alone in that. I mean, I think that the tools that we have to research the brain are amazing, and they're getting more and more amazing with every passing year. There's a lot of new technology that we can use that I think will fuel some really very useful findings, and I think that you know, thinking of it as a brain disorder is a very useful thing. It's useful in that I think it's going to lead to new treatments and biomarkers, but I also think it's important for us to think about, because there is such a denigration in society of those who suffer from substance use disorders and even from obesity and from anxiety and depression, and those things, you know, if they arise from barriers in the brain, you know, we need to understand that as a society. Everybody needs to come to that understanding so that we're not, you know, denigrating people for these biological problems that they're having.
And I also think, as much as we've medicalized certain issues that are to some extent part of life, we have to start to medicalize the concepts that health and healthcare involves more than running tests and giving out drugs.
Right.
So
yeah.
people who you know, they ran a study in Chicago with homeless people. Many of these people on the street were visiting the emergency room 150 or 200 times a year. When it was cold out, they'd come to the emergency room and they needed a place to sleep. And the ED nurses and so forth have to bring them in, et cetera. So they ran an experiment, and they gave them housing vouchers, and they set them up, and they had a place to live. And just about every health indicator began to get better for these folks. They stopped coming to the ED. They started to eat better. They started to lose weight. They started to deal with the addictive behavior that occurs when they're homeless, and so on and so forth. The concept that we have this health system spending all this money on people for whom their underlying social situation is catastrophic, and without interfering with that, you can have the best physicians and nurses in the world trying to correct this, and it's not going to happen. At Geisinger in Pennsylvania, they started a new pharmacy. It's a pharmacy where the first letter is F. So picture this grocery store with nutritional foods, and part of treating their diabetics is not giving them just insulin or hypoglycemic agents, but it's taking them into this store and teaching them how to shop and how to prepare foods and how to eat well. And if they can't afford the food, they give them the food. And the results in terms of diabetes control and A1C levels and all of the consequences of diabetes that one can measure are astounding. So it's not medicine, but it is.
Right.
It needs to become part of medicine. How we bring this together is, I think, one of the interesting challenges for us to face as a country.
But there, you know, the medical students, and most medical students, are now these days learning about what we call the social determinants of health. So you have your livers and lungs, you have the stuff that you yourself are doing to your body, but then you have all the rest of the stuff that's going on, which is what we've been talking about, like doctors giving out too many narcotics for things that don't, like high corn syrup drinks, like, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Undiagnosed depression was another major investment that I would do. But then that gets back to healthcare. If you can spend time with a patient and not 15 minutes and they can have access, then you can diagnose depression and get them into treatment. Because remember, of those 20 million people who are addicted, 6.8 million have mental illness that's undiagnosed.
So that sort of touched on the question. There was a nurse in the audience. She works at a hospital and kind of wanted to get a sense of how we promote these measures. And I think that you touched on, you know, granular levels of how we can increase education for our patients in our hospitals. And another one is just more on how we can find literature on the benefits of extended fasting.
Yeah, you know, honest to goodness, if you go to any search engine and type intermittent fasting, a torrent of material will come to you, and it needs to be discriminated, as most torrents of web material need to be discriminated. But a lot of it is excellent. There is one of the nice things about the intermittent fasting work that's going on today is you know, much of it is grounded in very serious science and with good solid measurement and good randomized controlled trials. It's coming out of the woodwork. You know, nutrition research is extraordinarily complicated. A lot of what we know is based on food histories. I mean, we would sit and ask you over the last year or, you know, over the last 5 years, can you describe to me what you've been eating? And, you know, I can hardly remember what I had for breakfast, but
nothing.
You did.
Well, listen.
Now I'm concerned about your memory.
I have to make a confession. I'm staying at a wonderful friend's house, and he is a great baker. And if you can come down in the morning to the smell of that bread and say, I'm on time restricted eating, so I'm just doing it for a few days. I promise I will be back to time restricted eating very, very soon. As soon as I can get out of here and get back home. But no, there's nutritional research is complex. It's why we can conclude that if you just stop eating fat, you'll be well. There's so much more to it than that. But I think a lot of the science is getting into the nutrition space now, and there's lots of good information out there on what it does. Is it good for you? What are the various ways that you can do it? There's another diet scheme, and there are books on this, the 5+2 diet, where for 5 days you're, you know, sort of eating ad lib, and for 2 days you are very seriously calorie restricting, which is something that also has seen success. So there's lots of information. Don't just sit there and say, I need to lose weight and I don't know how to do it. It's out there and you can do it.
There's another way too. You could convert to Judaism and fast on Yom Kippur, or Islam and Ramadan.
Right. So. Fridays eat fish. We had a question on pain, that pain is good for you, but we understand the addictive behaviors that can occur with pain, treatment of pain. Can we talk a little bit about how a consumer would manage their pain in speaking with their physician?
So there are just a couple of things. First of all, Tylenol, ibuprofen, naproxen, all those drugs, they do work. The dose, so I am, many of you know from previous things, that I'm a competitive athlete still at age 67, so I have a lot of aches and pains. So I often will take 600 milligrams of ibuprofen before I go to sleep. The other thing is that for those of you who haven't heard of it, there's a wonderful thing called mindfulness. Have you heard of mindfulness? Who's heard of mindfulness?
This is older.
All right. So a lot of you. But you, if you hadn't, it is a good way of coping with pain. There are courses here in Boulder by private folks, often hospitals where you're in your communities will have it, and it's a good way of dealing with pain.
But you know, the body has evolved, and evolutionary biologists speak brilliantly to this. The body has evolved in very sensible ways. If you sprain your ankle swells up. Why is that? The body is trying to immobilize that joint. That joint is not healthy right now. We're going to swell the tissues around it. We're going to make it uncomfortable to use, and we're going to make it hard for it to be mobilized. So what your body is saying is, please get off this ankle so it can heal, and et cetera, et cetera. What do we want to do? We want to go jogging tomorrow. We have a 10-mile race. So we put ice on it and heat on it and all kinds of stuff on it, and we take a lot of drugs and pain meds and this, that, and the other, and we just go on with our life, ignoring what our body is trying to say, which is take a few days off. So you can see this in so many other body systems where the body is trying to normalize and bring back homeostasis, and we're trying to medicate and to feed it, and there's a balance there. I'm not saying suffering is this is not a religious experience here, folks, but it's not all let's try to dodge these things that our body's trying to tell us.
Well, the other question was, and this is sort of, in the woolly mammoth, when we were chased by woolly mammoth, did we have these same responses? I know that we have chemical responses, changes to fear and anxiety, but, you know, this is a modern plague, or is this something that we've, had throughout time?
There are no data on human responses to woolly mammoths that have come down to us that I know of. You know, I don't know. My sense is that we have, as a species, been in this evolutionary state for a long time. The human body is not rapidly. Rapidly changing, and what we've done is adapt or place this organism in this new environment. When we were adapted for intermittent feeding and adjusting to fasting as part of our lives, and there's this a very old theory called the thrifty gene hypothesis. That is, the people who were most successful at living were the people whose genetic makeup allowed them to tolerate these periods without food, and to store energy at times when there was food, et cetera, et cetera. So you can imagine from an evolutionary standpoint, having this thrifty gene would be beneficial to you. And then you put this in the middle of abundance in the modern world, and we end up in energy imbalance. So it's I think we are seeing to some extent the species taken from a different. A different time and era where we adapted over tens of thousands of years, and we haven't had time to adapt to
the
feeding, to the stress, and I just think in our lives as well. You know, you look at when I grew up, there were three networks. We all watched the same shows. Was Cronkite better than Hundley and Brinkley, or the other way? You liked one or the other, and now you know, the show is on channel 792, and the news has to come at you. If it's more than 15 minutes old, it's old news.
Right. And that's the stress, finding channel 792.
But, you know, I don't know how well. I mean, I'm just speculating that we are adapted to this constant flow of stuff. There's just almost no downtime.
Yeah. And the new chemicals that we have now. I mean, you know, people have been chewing coca leaves for, you know, hundreds and thousands of years with good utility in South America. But when cocaine was chemically extracted from those and people started to use that, I mean, it had a very, very different effect. And so we have all sorts of new chemicals. We're getting more by the day. Our bodies certainly aren't adapted for exposure to those. And they pose some dangers, obviously.
Well, I think that's it for our questions, and I just wanted to thank our panelists. This is a great discussion.